Dietrich rode to St. Catherine, where he found a score of Krenken in uneven rows in the nave. Some were on their feet, others in their characteristic squat, three perched in the rafters. Joachim was in the pulpit, while a thick-set Krenk wearing a head harness translated for those who lacked one. "Where is Hans?" Dietrich asked into the silence that greeted his entrance. Joachim shook his head. "I've not seen him since the army left." One of the squatting Krenken buzzed, and the thick-set one said through the microphone, "The Beatus asks whether Hans lives. It is," he added with a Krenkish smile, "a weighty matter to her." His band performed valiantly in the conflict, Dietrich told him. One alone was slain, and Hans avenged him in a most Christian manner. "Please excuse me, I must find him." He had turned away when Joachim called, "Dietrich!" "What?" "Which of them was killed?" "The one called Gerd." This announcement, when translated, caused a great deal of clicking and buzzing. A Krenk began sawing his arms violently and repeatedly. Others reached out in quick, tentative touches, as if tapping his shoulder for his attention. Joachim, too, descended from the pulpit and imitated the Krenkish gesture. "Blessed are those who mourn," Dietrich heard him say, "for they shall be comforted. Sorrow is a moment, but joy is joy forever in God's presence." Outside, Dietrich remounted and tugged the reins around. "Come then, Sister Horse," he said. "I must call on your service this one last time." Kicking the horse in the ribs, he rode for the great woods, sending up urgent clots of mud from the sodden Bear Valley road. He found Hans in the Krenkish vessel. The four surviving Krenken clustered in a small room lined with metal boxes on the lower level. The room's walls were scorched, and no wonder. Each box had rows of small glass-filled windows, within which small fires burned, bright red, dull blue. Some changed colors while Dietrich watched. Other windows were dark, and the box itself marred by the fires that had wrecked the ship. One box was ruined utterly, its panels bent and twisted, so that Dietrich could see that inside were many wires and small items. It was on this box that Gottfried labored with his magic wand. He must have moved, for the Krenken turned suddenly. The Krenkish eye, Dietrich had learned, was especially sensitive to motion. When Dietrich pulled his head harness from his grip, Hans sprang across the room and slapped the microphone from his hands. Then, gripping Dietrich's wrist, led him up the stairwell to the room where they had first met. There, Hans activated the speakers. "Geshert controls the waves in no medium," the Krenk told him, "but this head talks only in this room. How did you know to find us here?" "You were not at Falkenstein, nor seen by any in the village. Where else might you have gone?" "Then Geshert does not yet know. The voice canals falling under interdict forewarned us of trouble, and we had Gerd to bury and the wire to install." Hans tossed his long arm. "It is cold here, but I understand now what your people mean by sacrifice. You went to the battlefield. Your countrymen fought over your actions, and I thought to warn you. I feared you would return to imprisonment, or worse." He hesitated. "The Herr said you forgave the man who killed Gerd." Hans tossed his arm. "We needed the wire, not his death. This wire, drawn by a true coppersmith, may prove meet to the task. No blame to the blessed Lorenz. Copper was not his duty. Come, let us return below. Remember, only Gottfried is with us in all things. Friedrich and Melchtilde have joined only from fear of the alchemist, not from next love." Dietrich watched for a time as the four Krenken attached wires and touched them with sundry talismans, perhaps to bless them with some relic. Once or twice they seemed to argue and consulted illuminated manuscripts of the electronic circuit. He tried to discern which of the other two was Mechtilde, obviously a Krenkerin, but though he studied them closely, he could spy no marked difference. Growing bored, he walked about within the vessel and came to the room that the Kratzer had once named the pilot room, though there was no window to show the pilot how the vessel lay, only panels of opaque glass, several of them darkened as if by fire. One of those flickered briefly to life, accompanied by a clatter of crankish voices from farther below. A padded high seat in the center marked the captain's throne from which he had issued orders to his lieutenants. Dietrich wondered what might have happened had that worthy survived. The captain might not have failed so badly as Geschert. Yet, being more competent than Geschert, might he not have, in typical crankish choler, rid himself of the risk of discovery by ridding himself of the discoverers? God worked all things to an end. What purpose was served by the events that had so joined a reclusive scholar-priest with a bizarre creature that instructed talking heads? Dietrich left the pilot's room and went to the outer door, where he breathed the fresh air. A distant cry echoed through the surrounding trees, and he thought at first that it was a hawk, but it was too prolonged and insistent. And it suddenly came clear, the whinny of a terrified horse. Dietrich spun about and ran to the stairwell, nearly tripping on his robe as he hurried down the steps. "Geschert comes!" he cried. But they looked at him not at all, and he realized that a human voice was to them no more than a sound, as their chittering was to him. So he grabbed Hans by the forearm. Reflexively, the crank slung him aside. Hans turned, and Dietrich could think of nothing better than to point toward the stairwell and shout, "Geschert!" hoping that the creature had heard the name often enough to recognize it without translation. It must have worked, for Hans froze for a moment before unleashing a stream of chatter at his comrades. Friedrich and Mechtilde put aside their tools and sprang for the stairwell, pulling Potiphar from their scripts as they did. Gottfried looked up from his work with the magic wand, and first waving away the vapors with his hand, made a tossing motion toward Hans. Hans waited a moment longer, then tilted his head as far back as he could before he too ran up the stairwell. Dietrich found himself alone with Gottfried, his first convert, unless one counted the alchemist's cryptic embrace of the words of consecration. Gottfried continued to affix wires to the minute posts with his solidaire metal. But Dietrich thought him aware of being watched. Gottfried put the wand aside on a pad that appeared woven of metal fibers, and using a screw twister, removed a small box from the circuit. This he tossed to Dietrich, who perforce must catch it, and put in its place a somewhat larger device that appeared built from odds and ends. Examining the device removed, Dietrich saw that instead of copper wires, there depended from the device sundry fibers so fine as a hair, and which seemed to trap light within themselves. Gottfried clicked his mandibles and gestured to the device Dietrich now held, and the more schlumpig device he had installed in its place. He spread his hands in a very human gesture and tossed his head several times, by which Dietrich understood that Gottfried doubted the electronicus would flow through the copper wires with the same efficacy as light had once flowed through the hair-like fibers. Having thus pantomimed his doubts, Gottfried made the sign of the cross, and bending once more to the task, dismissed Dietrich with a wave of his arm. Dietrich found Hans outside, crouched with the other two Kranken behind some metal barrels. Hans seized Dietrich's robe and pulled him too behind the barrels, where the sodden earth soaked his garments and chilled his limbs. The Kranken, he saw, was shivering. Although the day was but moderately cool to Dietrich's senses, he unfastened his cloak and hung it around Hans's shoulders. Hans cocked his head to look at Dietrich straight. Then he handed the cloak to the crank squatting beside him. This one, Mechtilde, Dietrich thought, took it and wrapped it tightly around her, clenching it close about her throat. The third crank squatted partly upright, peering over the tops of the barrels. Where a man might scan the surroundings, he held his head so motionless as a gargoyle. The better to apprehend motion within the woods, Dietrich supposed. From time to time the third crank absently fingered his neck. The horse had stopped her whinnies, by which Dietrich thought the beast had fled, unless Geschert had slain it. He raised his head to look toward the woods, and a sound like a bumblebee flew past him, followed a moment later by a sharp crack from the edge of the woods and the slap of a stone against the vessel behind him. Hans yanked Dietrich once more to the dirt, and snapped his mandibles a thumb's length from his face. The message was clear: make no sudden moves. Dietrich glanced at Friedrich and noticed that his left antenna had bent slightly to point toward a spot in the surrounding forest. Hans crossed his antenna and ever so slowly eased his podifer into position to sling a bullet at his attackers.